Welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I'm in for Sam today. It's Becky, and I've got Justin back in the studio, as well as Tom. Justin, it's nice to have you back. This is your second time on
my second time here.
The show. And Tom, it's old hat for you right now.
Anymore it is.
Yeah. So, what's your guy's favorite fried food?
Favorite Thrive?
Fried oil. The thing that's dunked in oil and at hot temperature.
Gotta be chicken.
Okay, fried chicken.
There's so much to choose from. I'll take mozzarella.
Okay, fried mozzarella sticks. All right. Well, you know, no latkes for you guys. No jelly donuts or anything.
Oh, I forgot about
because latkes. It is the final night of Hanukkah.
Oh.
Where, you know, the oil is everlasting. Unlike the actual petroleum products available at our Earth. Oh, that was a global warming and unrenewable resources, finite resources joke. So, you guys ever heard of, you know, I mean, clearly Christmas tree, right?
Right.
Okay, so a lot of Christmas trees in Christian folks' homes and in atheist folks' homes, right?
Mm,
now,
sure.
You guys grew up Christian or atheist or, you know, things like that? Okay. And as atheists now, do you have Christmas trees or sort of, you know, little plants in your homes now?
No, I'm too tired.
Okay. Yeah, precisely. Mind you, there's usually somebody else in the house hold where I'm at any one year who wants a Christmas tree, so I have a Christmas tree.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll help with someone else's Christmas tree.
Exactly.
As far as getting my own Christmas tree.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Had you guys ever heard of the Hanukkah bush trend?
No.
Oh, yeah. So this was something that definitely was present for me as a little Jewish child in the 80s, where some families would have a Hanukkah bush. It wasn't an evergreen tree, but don't laugh, Tom.
I'm
no,
sorry.
Laugh all you want, because that's what we did.
Was it
right?
A specific kind of bush?
It was. So there were the different kinds of plants that you could have in your home.
Some evergreen.
And you would hang little dreidels on them, or you would hang little Jewish stars on them and things like that. And it was a way for some of the families that had Jewish kids to help their kids not feel left out. I mean, for me, we would just go to our cousins or our neighbors and help them decorate their Christmas tree, and then they would come over and help us light our Hanukkah menorah, and, you know, everyone understood, this is what I do in my house, that's what you do in your house. But some kids really liked the idea of a Hanukkah
bush. Am I thinking about this the right way, to think that this is a burning bush type thing?
Yeah, see, a lot of us were just like, we don't want any burning bush type things like that. Last time that happened, you know, the story goes, we were stuck wandering in the desert for 40 years.
Just get a smoke machine in there. It'll be fine.
Is that that's a propylene glycol sort of puffy? All right. So had you guys ever heard of the Hanukkah George H.W. Bush?
The Hanukkah George H.W. Bush?
There is a different.
No. So, you had me lost back at Hanukkah Bush period.
now we have. So it's not uncommon to see presidents of the United States participating in learning about cultural observances, you know, the Easter egg roll, and you have someone attending an Eid breakfast, you know, during Ramadan, you know, to sort of share camaraderie with all sorts of Americans in our pluralistic multicultural society.
Thomas Jefferson had a Quran.
Oh, did he?
Mm.
Oh, very interesting. Mm. Okay. He also had his own little Bible that he really loved to get down to all the important business, right?
The moral philosophy Bible.
So here's one of the things that I remember about George Herbert Walker Bush is him being on television playing dreidel with a little Jewish kid, and he's spinning the little top. This is that four-sided top, and it's a game. It's a gambling game. Mm. Who knew, right? And spinning the little dreidel, and it lands on one of the letters, and he says, well, what does it land on? And she says, you landed on nun. It means you don't get anything. You can't do anything. You do nothing. And to me and to my family, and they weren't really good fans of George H.W. Bush at the time, that really was our favorite version of the Hanukkah Bush ever.
You tell them what's up, little kid.
I was thinking George H.W. Hanukkah Bush would be, you know, broccoli or something.
Oh, yes, because he really disliked that wonderful colon-enhancing roughage. Oh, we should totally do that. You know, there is Hanukkah's ending, you know, this week, and there's still a lot of time before Christmas. You could bridge the two holidays by putting your George H.W. Hanukkah bush, by having a really nice, you know, crown of broccoli, and you can hang any kinds of ornaments you want on it. So maybe decorate it with jelly beans. That was his favorite
candy.
Hang up
some pardons, some obstruction of justice.
Jelly beans was Reagan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, then I don't want to honor Reagan. No way. Because, you know, a Hanukkah broccoli would be great. But here we are. Here we are to talk about, on Ask an Atheist, George Herbert Walker Bush. Because it seems like this week, all we've heard are the glowing reviews. And I don't know. I'll just put it out there as an atheist. I have no compunctions about saying, oh, don't speak poorly of the dead because something's going to happen to them in the afterlife. I don't have a belief in an afterlife in the way that many religious people do. And I know that honoring someone in their death is important when there's amazing and wonderful things to honor them about. But at the same time, don't be so blinded by your need to honor someone's memory as to forget other unsavory parts of one's legacy. And I guess that's what we're here to talk about. Now, and
well, somebody's got to head the CIA.
Do we? Is that what has to happen? So, Justin, you and I are kind of that under 40 crowd, right?
Uh-huh.
And we weren't grown-ups when Bush was president.
I was 3 when he left office.
Okay. So you are definitely in the under 40 crowd.
I'm in the under 60 crowd. I remember him.
Okay. So you were a grown up at that time.
I was on active duty for pretty much all of his presidency.
So for Justin and I, we definitely had to do a little bit of research to see who really was this man. Because if we hadn't done any looking and just passively listened to what's going on in mainstream media, we'd see that this is someone who had a kinder, gentler approach to being conservative, who was a nice, you know, older man who sired one of the worst presidents, in my opinion. And that's kind of about where we left off. But, you know, doing some digging, it's really revealed some amazing stuff.
They kind of really super glued the rose-colored glasses on.
You think so this week?
A little bit, yeah.
So one of the things that we really wanted to dig into, I had not really realized the extent to which George H.W. Bush's campaigns for president in 1988 kickstarted a lot of sort of white fear and anxiety over a proverbial scary, violent black criminal. And I had to go looking up at, unfortunately, this Willie Horton campaign ad. Tom, do you remember what this ad was about? Do you remember actually seeing this campaign ad?
Oh, yeah. It was all over the airwaves back in during the day. Yeah. The way they presented it was a violent criminal in prison was out on furlough because of Dukakis.
Okay, which who
Governor was, Dukakis.
Bush's opponent at
yes,
the time.
Yes, he was running against Bush. And because he's out on furlough, he was able to murder somebody or something of the sort.
It looks like he escaped custody while on furlough and subsequently raped a white woman and assaulted her partner really brutally. And, you know, I was looking at this and it really is striking how the imagery that was used in this ad is much like the runaway slave posters, the wanted posters that were common during, you know, antebellum, you know, pre-Civil War United States.
He looked like just a bad actor is what he looked like in the ad.
And they certainly didn't try to paint him in any other light than that.
No.
And this was, you know, egregious enough that there were, you know, plenty of Republicans that kind of tried to pull back on this and said, whoa, 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 yeah, that's just way too much. But
Bush, give any further background, you know, to the whole larger situation going on.
Certainly. It turns out Bush never apologized for it. He never publicly said, yeah, that was wrong of me, or I shouldn't have, you know, incensed, you know, anti-black rhetoric in this way. Yeah. And it's
apparently Lee Atwater did. Apparently, Lee Atwater.
This is the GOP National Committee Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's something.
the Southern strategy guy apologized for the ad,
and this is just hardball politics from, you know, the perspective of certain people. It is actually, I remember going back a little further under Reagan. It wasn't it was the same kind of tactic when Reagan was talking about the. A specific individual who probably didn't actually exist, but was depicted as a specific individual who abused their welfare.
Oh, the welfare queen thing.
Yeah, it's the same dynamic, you know. Yeah. You throw something out there that is a single incident of something, and then you do it as a glittering generalization that this is all your taxpayer money is going to this.
Sort of implants that narrative within the mind of the public.
Yes.
I think that's one of the really important things as as a skeptic, because many atheists also consider themselves skeptics and or rationalists, and look at, hey, what is my mind believing? What am I apt to just accept because it's out there in the public discourse without really digging a little bit deeper? And, you know, that's something that I think in the last week for me, I've forced myself to do with regards to this late president. You know, he had an interface with religion, just like many Republican, you know, politicians, you know, from Eisenhower on, definitely did.
Well, even Democratic politicians also flirt with religion.
Certainly.
It's the mm-hmm. politically correct thing to do.
Right. A politically expedient thing to do, probably.
No, so, I mean, not the colloquial usage of political correctness, but like what political correctness actually is.
Yeah.
Like they cannot get elected if they don't do this like little flirtation with religion. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter what they believe or whether they believe, they just do it anyway.
Yeah, because it helps their campaign. Mm-hmm. So right before Desert Storm, apparently the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church was Edmund Lee Browning, and he insisted that going into Iraq, it would be immoral to use force. But Bush apparently countered that the Iraqi regime was immoral in the way it had treated its own people and those of Kuwait that it had annexed at the time. So even his own denomination, he got into a little tiff with the head of his religious denomination. You know, in 1991, the Episcopal Church ordained an openly lesbian woman, and Bush commented that, you know, perhaps he was a little too old-fashioned, but he's not quite ready for that. You know, it took him until like 2015 to say that he had mellowed a little bit on his ideas about gay folks being worthy of like anything.
He apparently witnessed some gay friends' wedding ceremony or something.
Yeah,
and he acted as the witness for.
Yeah, Barbara Bush and George H.W. Bush were the official witnesses of a gay wedding and of a wedding between two gay guys in 2013, and that was what he said mellowed him a little bit. You know,
I'm glad he finally came to his senses. It just would have been a little bit convenient if he had done that when he was still in a position of power,
still
to actually
in power.
Do something about that.
Yeah,
so
that would have been nice.
Yeah, you know, he wasn't so keen on folks that didn't align with his idea of family values. And of course, that includes, you know, that includes gay folks. I mean, he said that he doesn't think that gay folks can be parents, you know, and certainly, you know, stuff like marriage wasn't really in a large way on a national platform in the late 80s and 90s. You know, a lot of the LGBTQ community was just looking for like recognition of their humanity. But the way that Bush sort of conflated, you know, his, I guess, you know, looking down on gay folks because they weren't the traditional nuclear family, and the way he conflated that with his treatment of folks with AIDS. You know, a lot of people celebrate that he passed the Ryan White legislation and the ADA, American Disabilities Act, that prevented discrimination against people with HIV. It's kind of a little too late when you wait 10 years after, you know, a huge crisis that started in the very early 80s. Tom, you as a medical professional, I mean, you were sort of coming of age in your own career at the time that the AIDS crisis was really
When it was first being described, I had my nose in books in pre-med, and then following it as a medical student. But it also kind of kept me, I mean, I was, you know, sticking just to the science, awfully busy doing that. And I was pretty underwhelmingly informed about the social aspects of it, you know. However, one thing I do remember from that era that seems to have changed through the years, you know, I learned about something. Oh gosh, the French there are a couple of different teams that seem to have identified this virus, you know, human T cell leukemia virus 3. They renamed it HIV since then, and it was months and months and months later that the mainstream press was really writing about it. I thought that was odd, you know, something that important, and it just wasn't showing up in the press.
Was this seen at the time as a major breakthrough?
Yeah, to identify what's doing it. Yeah, you bet. I mean, it was.
It wasn't good.
Yeah, it was. It was one step, and it wasn't. It wasn't fundamental to how if you could identify the virus, you could at least tell if somebody was infected with it, which actually did have clinical implications. So in that respect, you know, you could determine that much anyway. It wasn't for a few more years that they started finding any kind of effective treatment.
And it certainly wasn't for a few more years that blood banks were screened, you know, across the United States. And there's still folks that harbor really ill will towards the American Red Cross for, at the time, refusing to push general screening of blood, of donated blood, even though that virus had been identified. I think that that's a really important thing to remember, not only at the time that George Herbert Walker Bush has passed on, but also at the time that really coincides with World AIDS Day. Because, you know, I guess in the 90s growing up, there was a lot of, you know, HIV education. It's mandated in the state of Washington that all students have HIV prevention and, you know, and AIDS education. But it seems like something that's not as blatantly on the radar. And I think that there's a great thing about that, because it means that so many people have access to treatment now, that and so many people have been able to survive for long periods of time despite being infected with HIV. And we don't have in our face the tragic and painful deaths of people perishing from this disease. But
oh, yeah, it was, I mean, everybody knew somebody that had died of it.
The fear was so present at the time, I've come to understand, that it was actually one of the major impetuses towards starting the Guantanamo Bay camps. And this was something that was completely new to me. Justin, did you know that? I mean, when you say Guantanamo, when people say Guantanamo, what do you think of?
I immediately think of extrajudicial detainment of human beings.
So post 9/11 stuff,
may
right?
Or may not have actually committed the crimes.
Right. We detain people that we think might be, you know, enemy combatants and stuff like that. Guantanamo's been around since the Bush era. He started it.
I think when I think of it, I think of the time the Air Force sent me there for 2 months to take care of some Haitians and Cubans.
So let's put this all in timeline. So we've got actually a coup that goes on in Haiti in 1991. You have numerous people from Haiti fleeing this coup, fleeing violence, and wanting to reach the United States to seek asylum. The United States is oddly not so keen on asylum, right? I mean, there might be some modern echoes of that today. Who knew? And actually, using the Guantanamo Bay naval base as a way to say, hey, let's not just have this for military folks, but have some place under U.S. control, but not on U.S. soil, where we can kind of screen these people and protect them and whatnot from whatever violence they're experiencing, but not have to bring them stateside.
Extreme vetting?
I guess, perhaps. Here was the extreme vetting that happened under Bush. HIV screening happened of all refugees.
That's good.
And 270 of them were segregated.
That's bad.
Forcibly sterilized if
that's
you were female
worse.
With HIV without their consent or knowledge. Well,
I'm trying to figure out how sterilization would affect transmission rates.
Yeah.
I guess because at that time, at least in 1991, we knew that HIV transmission happened through, you know, mother to child in many cases before you could get those, you know, or through breast milk and things
like
that.
So with the
like
pregnancy
that.
And not the, yeah.
Mm. So that was 1991. You have Haitian folks that are still detained there, that are still segregated. When were you in Guantanamo? Were you there under Bush?
It was under Clinton. It was a few years later, but there were still a few Haitian, people there. It was mostly by that time, the last big wave of Cuban migration, the Balsero rafters and the early wet foot, dry foot, you know, and if they were picked up on the water, they went to Guantanamo Bay and they were going to figure out, well, they wanted to be here. Mm-hmm. They liked America. They wanted to become citizens, at least in the large majority did. And the question was, is were they going to send them everyone back to Cuba or find another, or were we going to let them in and become citizens, which eventually slowly happened. And I caught the very, very tail end of that.
And you were there in
95, I think.
You were there in the capacity of a medical professional, right?
Yes, okay. Taking care of, because among other things, I mean, obviously people need, I'm a psychiatrist, people need mental health care, but Castro had among the voluntary migrants, Castro had dumped out his prisons and his mental hospitals.
Mm.
So we were taking care of the folks who were also out of the mental hospitals.
I remember this from Scarface.
That was the wave before. This was, Mary Alito. Same idea, though. Okay. Yeah.
So do you think that the legacy started by George Herbert Walker Bush of having Guantanamo Bay Naval Base open for individuals that were trying to escape one place and migrate to another, you know, was a good thing overall?
Now, mind you, I mean, I was there on active duty doing a very specific job, and it wasn't like I asked to go. They said, yeah, you're going to do this, and I did. I was feeling pretty good about it because there were very few Haitians left, and everything you were just describing about the sterilization and the there were very, very few folks from Haiti left there. And the impression I got was these are people who were probably going to go back to Haiti. I mean, do I know for a fact they did? No. But it's mostly the Cubans. And like I say, they were eager immigrants and really looking forward to it and willing to kind of put up with being detained there. And I actually felt like I was doing something good, you know, helping people on board. It was very different than it became after 9/11.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's places to say, hey, this is something that this is a place that was used in a different way. But I can't help but be nagged by the fact that George Bush's policies created the infrastructure for the Guantanamo prison base.
Oh, Camp Delta and Camp X-Ray started definitely back in that era.
So I think that there's so much to talk about in terms of George Bush and his legacies. But one of the things that really we want to dig into a little bit more is how George Herbert Walker Bush interfaced with the HIV and AIDS crisis. And for that, well, after the break, we'll be hearing from someone that experienced it directly and was involved directly. Stay tuned on Ask an Atheist, where you can call us at 844-SKEPTIC or tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA.
Have you or a loved one ever dealt with squiditis? Or have you ever had a life-changing problem? Squid Ink is your answer. Squid Ink cures back pain, depression, nicotine addiction. Concerned about your financial situation? Don't worry. Squid Ink pens will give you money. The Squid Ink atoms metabolize into pure, non-toxic happiness.
My name is Archibald Toothis. I used to be sad and lonely, but now I have two girlfriends, all thanks to the Squid Ink bracelets.
Side effects may include tentacle growth, itching, bruising, and happiness.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. Our voicemail number is 844-SKEPTIC. And we're really excited right now to help explain a little bit more in depth about some of the legacy of George H.W. Bush. And for this, we've got someone awesome on the phone with us. Ingrid Nelson is a nurse practitioner providing primary HIV care in California's Bay Area and through the California State Prison System. For almost 20 years, she joins us today to reflect on her experience as an AIDS activist with ACT UP San Francisco in the late 80s and early 90s. During the George H.W. Bush administration. Welcome, Ingrid.
Thank you.
So sometimes it's a little bit hard to pin down exactly ACT UP was and is. Some people describe it as a movement, an organization. How would you describe how it's organized?
We were a nationwide and actually international activist organization. We described ourselves as nonviolent grassroots. We had a mission statement that I'll try to repeat, united in anger to use direct action to bring about the end of the AIDS epidemic. So we did have chapters in cities around the United States and around the world. We had weekly meetings. Most chapters did not have any kind of officers or leadership. We made group decisions by, at least in San Francisco, by consensus. And we were very, very much street activists was how we saw ourselves.
Very interesting. Ingrid, this is Justin. Hi. My question is, what motivated you to participate in ACT UP?
Well, I would say AIDS was one of the first issues that radicalized me. I mean, I've been considered myself a liberal and a progressive for as long as I've been politically aware. I was in ninth grade when Ronald Reagan got elected president, and I was already very passionate about the issue of abortion rights. And so I've been worried about the composition of the Supreme Court since I was 14 years old. And so, you know, I always knew that I was opposed to the religious right and to the issue of abortion and reproductive rights. And then when I was in college, I realized that I was a queer person and was also aware that there was this epidemic happening in our country and that the government wasn't doing anything about it because it was primarily affecting gay people. And I read the book And the Band Played On by Randy Schiltz, who was a gay man, a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, which, you know, the Bay Area is where I grew up. And I had been reading stories in the San Francisco Chronicle about, you know, the AIDS ward at San Francisco General Hospital and about the very first AIDS ARC vigil, which happened at the Federal Building, I believe in 1985 in San Francisco. So these were all kind of things that were on my radar. I didn't know any people who were HIV positive at that time, but I knew that this epidemic was happening and that people were suffering and dying because the government thought that they deserved it. And even though it was clear pretty early on that queer women were not primarily affected by this epidemic directly, although I will say I've had friends and patients who were lesbian or bisexual women who had HIV, you know, it wasn't as much of an epidemic in our community, but we were seeing what was happening to our gay male friends, and we knew that it could just as easily be us, that the government didn't care either way. So it was hard not to take that personally. I went to, this would have been my senior year in college, went to the March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. We didn't use the term LGBT back then. And that was the first time I saw the quilt, the Names Project quilt, which was also created in San Francisco. And ACT UP New York was present at that march. In 87 was the year that they formed. The group did form first in New York. And so I remember seeing the quilt, seeing people all around me crying and seeing these names and these faces, and the White House was right in the background, and of course, the president didn't come or acknowledge it in any way. And then I remember seeing this group of people with the Silence Equals Death t-shirts and their leather jackets, and they had these posters with a neon image of Ronald Reagan with these glowing eyes, and it said AIDS Gate. And they just had such a striking visual presence, and I was just immediately drawn to them and wanted to know more about what was going on. And then when I graduated from college in 88 and moved to San Francisco, I joined ACT UP almost immediately afterwards, and one of the first protests I remember is protesting the George H.W. Bush inauguration in January of 89.
Wow.
So he was always president while I was an AIDS activist.
Wow.
So it very much was in his shadow that I experienced all of that.
Hi, Ingrid. This is Tom. Many ACT UP participants were subject to arrest. What was your experience with this?
I definitely thought that civil disobedience was an important part of the work that we were doing, and it was very clear to us that we were more likely to make the news if there were arrests at our protests.
Part of it was to be arrested for civil disobedience?
Yes, absolutely. Usually by, you know, blockading streets or buildings, you know, that was definitely how we would bring attention and how we would get on the news, because one of the big slogans of ACT UP was say the word AIDS. This was a day and age when nobody was talking about it. And we were literally just trying to get the word out that this was happening and that people were dying. People often describe the experience of being a queer person in the 80s and 90s as feeling like you were living through a war that was right under everybody's noses, and yet it was invisible. And a lot of people that I've spoken to since George H.W. Bush died said that they felt like that was happening all over again, that he had died and everybody was talking about what a great guy he was. And we were all saying, isn't this the same person that, you know, we were all protesting and that was doing so much harm and, you know, expressing so much indifference and bigotry against us and our friends who were dying. And it really did feel invisible, and it felt important to us to make noise and to cause inconvenience and disruption, and that we were operating as if it was an emergency all the time. That's what it felt like. And, you know, our answer to everything, every criticism was people are dying and we have to do something.
You know, I think that your words really echo what Masha Gessen had written in The New Yorker this week.
A lot of the
tributes to the late president, you know, I think that the quote was, you know, it transported queer people in this country back to an era where you were systematically elided from the public sphere. But
exactly.
At the same time, we have journalists, one Neil Braverman, who is a journalist with the gay publication The Advocate, and he titled his obituary, George H.W. Bush, no ally, but no enemy of LGBTQ people dead at 94. Where do you place right. Bush on that continuum of enemy to ally for LGBTQ folks?
At the time, absolutely 100% enemy. I mean, I do think that there are some people who kind of softened over the years, and I think he probably was in that category, but I don't think he ever apologized or acknowledged all the harm that he did while he was president. I mean, he was perfectly happy to be silent along with Reagan for 8 years while this epidemic was raging and while people in the Reagan White House were mocking and laughing about the fact that people were dying. And were perfectly happy to take money and power from the right-wing evangelists who were saying that people with HIV should be tattooed and should be put in camps and, you know, deserved to suffer and die. That was all happening under his watch. And he never apologized for that. He never acknowledged that. And while he was president, he said a lot of really hateful things. He said that, you know, yes, of course, we should give money to AIDS research, but it's not like, you know, there aren't behavioral issues that are causing people to get this illness. And that should affect how we deal with this crisis, is to acknowledge the fact that this is your fault, that you got this disease. And he was very much, you know, he would say openly that he thought that same-sex relationships were not normal and that same-sex couples should not be parents. You know, he never apologized that I know of for any of that. And it absolutely increased the suffering and the death for there to be that much indifference from our country's leadership. And I think it's perfectly legitimate to say that this was genocide and that it was taking place on Reagan's watch and on Bush's watch.
Ingrid, it's Justin again. With some of the things, the rhetoric that they were saying about this in that kind of context, ACT UP was known for thumbing its nose at the idea of civility. Do you think modern calls for civility are misguided as well?
Yeah, I've never been much for tone policing. I hear the same things being said about Black Lives Matter and so many other social movements that are going on right now that I absolutely support. And I think, again, that a protest is not going to be effective if it doesn't make people uncomfortable in some way. Mm-hmm. That you have to convey that this is a really serious issue and that it does affect us all and that we can't just be silent when people are dying and suffering. And I am not, you know, I'm not interested in making people hate us. I don't think that's the goal. But I do think that protest needs to make people uncomfortable. It needs to disrupt daily life and social order in some kind of real way if it's going to be effective.
If the problem is people aren't.
People said the same thing about the civil rights movement and feminism and every other social movement ever has been criticized for not being polite and nice enough.
If the problem is people aren't paying attention, you need to find a way to make them pay attention.
Exactly. And it worked. It absolutely worked. That's the thing, is that, you know, any changes that happened were absolutely affected by the fact that people were making noise and getting on the news. And, you know, it was very real suffering that people were going through and making that visible. I mean, one of the biggest protests that happened during H.W. Bush years was at the White House when people from ACT UP took the ashes of their friends and loved ones that had died.
I was really hoping you would.
The White House lawn.
Yeah, I was really, really hoping you would tell
that
us about
a particular favorite of mine.
Ashes in action.
And you can You can find that on YouTube if you just look for Ashes at the White House. I don't remember exactly what the video is called, but you can absolutely see it. It's also in the documentary that just came out a couple years ago called How to Survive a Plague, which is a documentary about ACT UP. There are several good documentaries about ACT UP, and most of them focus on New York rather than San Francisco or the other cities, but they were the biggest and they were the first, so there's some legitimacy to that. But yes, they were largely the ones that did that action, and it's absolutely the most, you know, one of the most devastating videos of political protest that I've ever seen. And I remember those days when people were going to three funerals a week, and it really felt like no one was acknowledging it. There was also a protest where a dead body in a coffin was brought to the Republican headquarters in New York City.
Was that Mark Fisher?
For the Bush reelection, and his body was left on the steps of that building as protest.
Definitely, and very dramatic.
His wishes for when he died.
These actions are definitely really dramatic and very powerful. I mean, to have the literal body, the literal remains of a loved one, or the cremated remains of your loved one scattered, you know, but not just scattered, dumped on the White House lawn or paraded in front of the, you know, reelection headquarters. You know, Bush actually characterized ACT UP's protest as an excess of free speech. And I wanted to know, Ingrid, what's your take on the current zeitgeist where we have cries for free speech that are really sometimes proxies for explicitly racist or white supremacist or religious dominionist actions?
Yeah, that's really true. And I, you know, another favorite, I'm just going to say that another favorite phrase of HW was militant homosexuals. He loved to call us that. And it sounds so quaint now, but at the time it was, you know, really kind of hate speech. It's so interesting. I have become somewhat less of a free speech absolutist than I used to be. I do think that it would favor hate speech laws in some situations where you're actually calling for the genocide of specific people and actually inciting violence the way, you know, things happened in Charlottesville last year, say, you know, to actually be using social media to encourage people to bring weapons to a protest and to say, we're going to get the, you know, the black people or the queers or whatever. I don't think that should be protected speech. And there was a time when I did think that. I do think that there's a role for deplatforming. There was another ACT UP action that we got criticized for, which was at the 6th International Conference on AIDS, which took place in San Francisco in 1990. And there was a whole week of protests. People came from all over the world because it was the first time that the head of state of the International AIDS Conference didn't come. Bush didn't come. He sent his director of health and human services instead. His name was Louis Sullivan. And so I looked online to see if I could find video of this protest, and I couldn't. But we basically made a very conscious decision that we were not going to let him speak, that we were going to shout him down. And that's what we did. And he wasn't able to make his speech, or no one was able to hear what he did say. And we talked a lot about that, about, you know, we're a civil disobedience group. We believe in protests and free speech and people getting to say their piece and all of that. But we just decided that it would be a very powerful statement to say, no more words, we want action. And that was the slogan of that protest, was that we weren't interested in hearing what they had to say until they were going to actually do something.
So,
and also just that it was so insulting that they were sending an official rather than the president, when all the other global AIDS conferences had had the head of state present there.
Ingrid, what would you say to young people now about protesting in an ACT UP type movement?
There's definitely things that are different. One thing that I've done since the presidential election of 2016 is that, and after the Charlottesville protests, I decided I wanted to become a street medic because I have a lot of experience with street protesting, and I'm also a medical provider. And so I thought, well, this is something I can do, is I can come to protest with a medic bag and help people who have been beaten by the police or tear gassed or whatever. And so I'm with a group of street medics now that does that. And I will say that it feels scarier than it used to. And some of that may just be that I'm older and more risk averse than I was when I was 22 and, you know, got arrested 9 times and thought nothing of sitting down in the street and getting dragged off. And those things feel scarier now. And I think some of it is because the police are more militarized and they do have, you know, tanks and armored vehicles and all these things. And of course, for somebody who's a member of a community that is specifically targeted by the police, whether that's a visibly queer person or whether that's a Black or Latinx or person of color, I do think that it is a more dangerous thing than it used to be. I mean, obviously for, you know, the civil rights movement and, you know, say what happened in Selma, like, you know, that's always been dangerous for Black people. But I do think it feels a little different now, but I still see amazing protests, you know, when the ICE detainees, the families were being separated. There were some great, huge acts of civil disobedience. I do still think there's a role for it, and I do still think it's very powerful. And I encourage people to, if they're interested in doing any kind of direct action or supporting direct action, that they attend a civil disobedience training, which most cities will have an activist group that does those on a regular basis. And it is important to know how to be safe and how to keep the people around you safe.
Really interesting words. And maybe we can look up in the Tacoma and Seattle areas, what are the kinds of groups or individuals that provide those kinds of trainings? We welcome our listeners to write in at atheist.radio or find us on Facebook there. Ingrid, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this, you know, legacy from a really, really, you know, personal perspective.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ingrid Nelson is a nurse practitioner providing primary HIV care in California's Bay Area and throughout the California state prison system, and has been for doing so for almost two decades. She joined us today to reflect on her experience as an AIDS activist with ACT UP San Francisco in the late 80s and early 90s during the George H.W. Bush administration. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Ask an Atheist.
Beware Squid Ink. The Sikasum magnets don't work. You don't run any faster. Warning, they shock you. True fact. Also, they are way too expensive, and all they want is your gold. They are taking over the world, one bracelet at a time.
Mamma mia, here we go again.
Hi, I'm Professor Poopy Pants.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I want to give a shout out to ACT UP Seattle for the awesome stuff that they did in the 90s, where they were really advocating for safe sexual practices being known and being understood by high school kids. Maybe, you know, wasn't so appropriate in the eyes of many, but it started a push for a lot of the HIV and AIDS education that went on in Washington. And I think it really jump-started a lot of cool stuff. So here in Seattle, in Western Washington, ACT UP was doing its thing here. So
excellent.
Teenagers are going to do what teenagers are going to do. It's a good idea to have them have good information first.
And they go on to have sex later, too.
Yeah. Eventually, they don't become teenagers, and they become adults, too. Yeah. So we are here at Ask an Atheist discussing the legacy of George Herbert Walker Bush with me, Becky, and Justin, and Tom. And, you know, besides all of his effect, his direct effect on folks living with or affected by HIV and AIDS, he's got some lasting effects in our politics as well, in our political infrastructures. And Justin, you really started digging into this because you've got a really keen interest in modern politics. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, where did all of these things come from? And it got you digging into Iran-Contra. And that's something that was never taught to me in history class. Was it taught to you?
No.
I mean,
I first found out about Iran-Contra, like, granted, I'm 29 years old. So I first found out about Iran-Contra from American Dad.
Okay. Excellent source of historical education.
Well, they actually did a pretty good job. They were making the joke, you know, one of the little punchlines at the end there is like, wow, I was entertained and informed, and I kind of was. And then I went on from there, which is what you got to do. You hear a little nugget of something and you got to look into it further.
Okay. Now, as someone who was going to be in the military, Tom, what, you know, did the Iran-Contra affair sort of give you pause before entering any kind of military service?
I was on active duty by the time that hit.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I just, what I, it kind of, erupted, and Reagan got on the air and said, I really didn't know, and I kind of believed them.
Was this a time that we now know in retrospect Reagan was a little bit of...
And they were taking advantage of it.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So here's the thing. We all know that under Reagan, we had the Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, who prior to that was a CIA director. So there was certainly no political mystery of all sorts of things for this Mr. Bush. And
the CIA had a reputation for all kinds of chicanery.
Okay.
In the era. They still do, except it seems a little different kind of chicanery now. But yeah, it's
a very kinder and gentler way.
Not really. It's just different.
Of characterizing CIA actions, Tom.
I've known people in the CIA who are really good people, but.
a kinder and gentler chicanery.
Yeah. Let's not get carried away.
So what really is Bush's legacy with regards to Iran-Contra, Justin?
Okay, so the Iran-Contra affair itself is extraordinarily complicated. Basically, they wanted to fund one side of a proxy war against the spread of communist and leftist
communists.
So they had to figure a way to do that because Congress had explicitly said they couldn't.
Okay.
So there was like back channels and arms deals. Iran got involved, and Iran was messing with Iraq at the time, and they had some other stuff going on with Russia. There's a bunch of different players, but the Iran-Contra affair itself is super complicated. I highly recommend people like look into the details of what actually happened there to get the process. As far as Bush Sr.'s legacy in it, he was, as you said, the vice president at the time that this was going on, and had previously been the director of the CIA, and that sort of put him in a position where he knew, as Tom said, good people that worked for the CIA, trustworthy folks that could be counted on to do certain things. And since it's a clandestine organization, things kind of go a little bit under the radar, not necessarily all that legal. His specific legacy in the Iran-Contra affair is more prevalent after it was over, after the Reagan administration and under his administration.
Okay, so when he became president.
When he became president.
All right.
And while he was president, close to the time that he was on his way out, because there had been...
Not to his knowledge, because he was still wanting to do another, 4 years, right? Or had the election kind of already happened? And
I can't quite remember the timing. It was very near the end of his presidency. The thing of it was is that the investigation was coming to a head.
Okay.
Like, that was the thing that was more pressing on his mind rather than electoral success or failure. So he pardoned 6 key figures in the Iran-Contra affair.
Oh, pardons. Okay. Pardons usually happen towards the end of a presidency when you know that you're on your way out.
And so in total, there were 4 misdemeanors, 1 guilty plea, 2 felony convictions, and trials for 2 more people that were about to start. But with the pardons that were laid out, those trials didn't happen. But there were already, crimes were committed here. We have convictions, we have guilty plea, all kind of stuff. More trials are about to start. And one of the people who was pardoned, whose trial was about to begin, maybe a month after the pardon, was going to be a guy who was going to call Bush Sr. He was going to call Bush Sr. as a witness to the stand, and he was going to have to testify.
Mm-hmm, tricky.
Which would have opened up to a lot of legal culpability there if it had been allowed to go forward, but it wasn't. In an effort to defend the pardons, because he's obviously not the kind of man who's just going to come right out and say that he was doing it to save his own skin, he said that the common denominator of their motivation, whether their actions were right or wrong, was patriotism.
Patriotism. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So you can have anything excused just as long as you meant well for your flag.
Right. Well, and even then, I recall thinking, by what standards is this patriotic? This was after the Iran hostage from about 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And so Iran, they were not getting along with this. These were Republicans who were giving Iran arms in order to, it was to cut this big swaparoo deal that ended up back in Central America kind of thing.
The Reagan administration wanted to fund the Contras in Nicaragua.
Uh-huh.
And It's fascinating, but it's complicated. They wanted to give money to the Contras in Nicaragua, but they couldn't just directly fund them. They were fighting against the Sandinistas, which is a left-wing organization in Nicaragua. So what they did was they sold arms to the Iranians and then took the proceeds from that and funneled it through back channels to get it.
They were doing deals with a country that, of course, they hate again. And mm-hmm. But at the time, it made perfect sense. It was perfectly patriotic.
And this patriotism issue comes up and is a sore spot specifically for atheists as well. You know, many atheists have actually seen in the last week or so a quote where allegedly George Bush had said, "I don't know that atheists should be regarded as citizens, nor should they be regarded as patriotic. This is one nation under God." Justin, that really got in your craw, right?
Yeah, I don't know that people who commit a little light treason should be considered patriotic.
What's worse? Causing the deaths of many people while doing back channel deals and involving, you know, major weaponry, or failing to believe in a God.
They were doing in runs around Congress. They were lying to Congress. Oliver North, I think that was the big thing they were getting him on. He's lying to Congress.
Yep. So I do want to, though, bring up a little bit that quote. There's
shredding documents, destroying evidence.
Ooh, is that another thing that was going on? Okay, all right.
Oh, yeah.
So Hemet Mehta of the Friendly Atheist blog on the Pathos Network, he actually raised really good skeptical questions regarding that atheism, you know, patriotism sort of alleged quote from Bush, because really seems like there's conflicting timelines. The reporter himself, Rob Sherman, had some really maybe not so pure motivations. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of corroboration from any other member of the press that was allegedly present during this particular exchange. It was at a big press conference and everything. So, you know, while it might be easy for us as atheists or as non-believers to get on George Bush's case for saying, what, atheists can't be president? Or can't be presidents. He'd probably thought that too. But he said, what, atheists can't be citizens or shouldn't be citizens, and they shouldn't be regarded as patriots? That may not have been something that Bush actually said.
That strikes me as a bit far out there, even for him. I mean, it just doesn't quite ring.
But it's not far out there in modern contexts.
I'm talking about him.
many Republicans will, in fact, doubt your ability to be a patriot or to love this country or your even right to be a citizen if you don't believe in their particular flavor of God.
Well, the conservative movement in this country have gone way back on some of their, you know,
I
used to be progressive.
I do find it difficult to believe that Bush Sr. would have said that in an interview that was recorded, but there's no doubt in my mind that he would have said that in the privacy of his own home, or had that thought in the privacy of his own head.
Yeah.
Would not surprise me at all.
Okay. All right. That's fair. So, speaking of motivations, though, Bush had a particular, you know, that particular motivation of saying, like, oh, they're patriots. So, you know, whatever I do, they're patriots, and that should excuse any of their crimes. Right. Mm-hmm. What do you guys make of that? I mean, especially at a time where we're looking at perhaps members of our current government who find themselves to be patriots hook for major crimes.
How are you defining patriotism here?
He was trying to put an end to the Cold War. And one of the angles by which he was going to accomplish that was by making communism lose. And if they define it that way, then okay. But, I mean, that's a stretch. That's a real stretch.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me following the Constitution is patriotic.
I would think that this country was built on the rule of law.
Yeah.
So I want to fast forward now back to the present, where we had all surviving presidents and lots of dignitaries present at the funeral ceremonies for George H.W. Bush. But there were some eyebrows that were raised. Donald and Melania Trump raised eyebrows for their silence during the late President Bush's funeral when attendees were reciting the Apostles' Creed. Presidents Carter, Clinton, Obama, and their wives all recited the prayer in unison, as the funeral service program had indicated, while the Trumps stood with hands folded, declining to even glance at their program during the recitation. The prayer is a statement of faith central to many Christian denominations, including Episcopalianism, which Bush belonged to, and Presbyterianism, the sect that Donald Trump has said that he identifies with. What do you guys make of this?
Well, Donald Trump can't read, and Melania can't read
English. Yeah, he would have
English,
mispronounced so. It. Had he-
I mean, I will say that I, you know, as a literacy instructor, there are real signs that point to Trump's struggles, possible struggles with basic reading comprehension.
Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we just be glad that he didn't cause a scene?
Well, some people say that this did cause a scene. The fact that he was out of sort of unison with all the other sort of ways that we perform at these particular events. Some people are saying, I'm glad he didn't recite it because he didn't believe that.
When Trump is causing a scene by keeping his mouth shut.
Oh, that's the best kind of scene, right?
There's a lot of discussion about how the bar has been lowered. And I mean, it has, but it's also that the game has been changed from high jump into
hopscotch.
No, not hopscotch.
Limbo.
Limbo. Yeah.
Yeah. Except now they're digging trenches in the ground to put the bar down to. Yeah.
So let me put this forth. A lot of people will think that Trump is actually an atheist. You know, he'll pander to evangelicals and whatnot. But him believing God, I don't find them to be an atheist, because you can't be an atheist if you think you are God. But
yeah, exactly. That's what I was.
I mean, but if you're there and you've got someone else's prayer, do you as an atheist feel bothered if you're kind of asked to recite it at a ceremony?
If I'm just chilling in the back, no, I don't feel compelled to do that. Standing on American tradition and what is expected as the current head of state, then it's sort of the least you could do.
Yeah, there's a time and a place for a principled stand, but I wouldn't worry about this.
Well, current president of the United States, for how much longer? We'll see after the new year.
6 months.
You're giving it 6 months?
I'm putting a nickel down on 6 months.
Tom, what's your guess? 6 months?
A little bit longer? I dare not, because I'll lose my nickel.
What a patriot you are. You've been listening to Ask an Atheist. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Becky.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And thank you to Ingrid Nelson. You can tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. Email us questions@atheist.radio. Find all our back episodes at atheist.radio. And keep listening to us, patriots.